Right, well, let's now talk about 3D strain state. There is a 3D more circular strain, which we could consider, but we're not going to, in a similar way to not considering. The next thing, which is the strain tensor, which we could also consider, but we will consider this next year instead. There is one area here which is important to note at this point of your studies, which is that the strain tensor will look something like this, and you'll see that instead of talking about gamma xy, in fact gamma xy over 2, where gamma xy is known as the engineering shear strain, we talk about epsilon xy, where that's known as the mathematical shear strain. It's a shorthand because we know that gamma divided by 2 is the really important strain, shear strain to consider. But as I say, we'll deal with that next year. Let's talk now about strain gauges and how we actually measure these strains that we've been talking about. What we do is we use a strain gauge, which looks something like this, where this is short, this is perhaps 5 millimetres long, and we wrap a wire back and forth, back and forth, back and forth like this. We stick this to the material, and when the material stretches, the wire itself stretches, and because it's wrapped back and forth like that, we have an amplification effect in the strain which is being read. So, importantly, strain gauges only read strain in the direction in which the straining has occurred. We cannot measure strain, shear strain directly, but we have a cunning trick to be able to do this. So we either use 60 degree rosettes, where the strain gauges are placed at 60 degrees apart, or 45 degree rosettes, where they're placed at 45 degrees apart. So let's consider the 45 degree one. If we have a 45 degree rosette with the two strain gauges which are aligned at 0 and at 90 degrees, we'll clearly measure epsilon xx and epsilon yy, so that's nice and easy. And then what we do is we use the equation that we stated previously, and we plug in, we say to ourselves that the strain at 45 degrees, which we can measure, must equal this side of the equation, and we can plug the numbers in which we've got, where gamma xy is now our variable. Rearrange that equation and we can easily solve for gamma xy if we know what the strains are at 0, 45 and 90 degrees. So that's nice and easy. So we can calculate that, and we can do exactly the same thing with the 60 degree rosette. This is slightly more complicated because to start with we only have one strain which is known, one original strain epsilon xx which is known. The other two are not known, but we can solve this equation twice simultaneously and we can easily enough find what epsilon yy and gamma xy are. So, using either of those forms of strain gauges gives us the results we want. So let's now move on to what happens to materials when they begin to yield. And what we're going to do is we're going to assume elastic, perfectly plastic material, and we're going to assume that the material therefore will yield at a plateau, and it will yield when its yield strength reaches capital Y. So Y is called the uniaxial yield stress of the material. So that's the assumption we're going to make. And the problem, of course, is, well, it's very easy to determine when a material will yield if you're just stretching it in one direction. But what happens if we're stressing it in all sorts of directions, and including normal stresses and shear stresses? How do we know when it will yield? Well, a couple of things to bear in mind. Plastic straining is due to the movement of dislocations driven by shear stress, terribly important point. And hydrostatic stress never causes yield. So if that's the case, then there are two famous models, the Tresca yield criterion and the von Mises yield criterion, which we're going to describe now, and they will define for us two distinct models to give us the stress state which will cause yield in any particular material. And we're only going to be dealing with the principal stresses in the material. So let's start with Tresca. Tresca stated that a body will yield when the maximum shear stress reaches a critical value. Seems to be a sensible starting point. So what will that critical value be? Well, let's go back to a very simple Mohr circle. If we have a material, imagine this is a long bar, and we're stretching it, it will yield, of course, when the yield stress reaches Y, and we have zero stress being applied in the other two directions. And we can draw the Mohr circle for that. At the origin, we will have sigma 2 and sigma 3, both being 0, and sigma 1, of course, will be Y. And that means that the maximum shear stress from the circle will be Y upon 2, the radius of the circle. And that must therefore be the critical value. But of course, we could say that it's the diameter from there to there being a value of Y, which is the critical state. And that is what Tresca says. So what Tresca says is that the diameter, the maximum distance of any of these three combinations, sigma 1 minus sigma 2, or sigma 2 minus sigma 3, or sigma 3 minus sigma 1, their absolute values, when they reach the diameter y of the circle, then we will have yield. So we need to check each of those three criteria, check it against y. In other words, when that circle reaches a certain diameter, yield will occur. And that is in the structures data book on page 4. So let's have a look at visualizing Tresca for plane stress to see what it actually looks like in terms of combinations of stress. What we can do is we can plot the yield surface on a so-called interaction diagram. So what we've got here is we've got on the vertical axis sigma 2, tension upwards, compression downwards, on the horizontal axis sigma 1, tension and compression. And we know to start with that we have four distinct points. And these points are, if I started at the origin and simply stretched a material in the one direction, it would yield when we reached Y. Equally, it would yield when it reached Y in compression and in compression. So we have those four points to start with, nice and easy. Now bear in mind that we are presuming that sigma 3 is equal to 0. And that means that if we have a stress state, for instance, where we start rising up that line, then we have sigma 1 being applied, and we have sigma 2 being applied, but sigma 2 is kind of irrelevant because sigma 1 minus sigma 3, according to Tresca, equals y. And so therefore sigma 3 is the dominant effect as we come up this line. Sigma 2 doesn't really matter because it lies between sigma 3 and sigma 1. Therefore there's a vertical line up there. And in this zone over here, we have a very similar thing. In this zone, it doesn't really matter what the value of sigma 1 is because sigma 1 will lie between sigma 2 and 0, sigma 3, and therefore we have a horizontal line. And we can do the same thing there and there for the yield criteria. This line there and that line there, they're altogether more interesting because in these situations over here, we have a positive value of sigma 1 and a negative value of sigma 2, which means that sigma 3 lies between sigma 1 and sigma 2. So the equation of that line is sigma 1 minus sigma 2 is equal to y, and that one is sigma 2 minus sigma 1 is equal to y. So these equations, these lines, all match perfectly with the Tresca yield criterion, and that becomes the yield criterion according to Tresca. So to put things into equations, four points are known. They're marked as x in the previous plot, so in terms of uniaxial stretching or compression of materials. And then we have those six lines, and each one has the equation associated with it written down here. All of these relate directly to the Tresca yield criterion. So what about if sigma 3 is not equal to 0? What happens if it's bigger? Well, what happens if it's bigger, of course? Let's just take an example. If I start at the origin here, 0, and I start compressing material in the one direction, but sigma 3 is not 0, sigma 3 is a tension being applied, then sigma 2 is irrelevant to us because sigma 1 minus sigma 3 must equal y. And if the absolute value, I should say, of sigma 1 minus sigma 3 must equal y. And if sigma 2 lies between those two values, it's an irrelevance. And therefore, we can't go all the way to y because sigma 1 minus sigma 3 must equal y. And y and sigma 3 is already a tension. Therefore, we have to stop early. In other words, if we apply a sigma 3, if we have a sigma 3 which is not equal to 0, the effect is to move that original dashed plot up and down along a 45 degree axis. That's the effect of ensuring that sigma 3 is not equal to 0. So let's do a particular example. So a thin walled cylinder with closed ends has radius 50 millimeters, thickness 1 millimeter, and is made of material with a uniaxial yield stress of 100 newtons per square millimeter. That's a relatively weak material. What internal pressure can the cylinder withstand before it yields according to the Tresca yield criterion? Well, these are the stresses, the principal stresses that we know. The hoop stress, the longitudinal stress, and the through thickness stress. And of course, we can very easily draw more circle for that. That's the hoop stress, that's the longitudinal stress, that's the through thickness stress, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. And we have to determine, we have to work out the maximum of that one minus that one, or that one minus that one, or that one minus that one must equal y. And of course it's obvious that it's the biggest one, that one minus that one, sigma 1 minus sigma 3 in this particular case, clearly, which is going to be the critical one. And so we can simply say that the radius of the big circle will be y, therefore PR upon t must equal y, and we can plug in the numbers that we've been given, and we find that we could internally pressurize this cylinder by 20 bar, because the value of internal pressure is 2 newtons per square millimeter. Now let's apply the von Mises-Yor criterion. Von Mises-Yor criterion is slightly different. What von Mises said was that a body will yield when the strain energy of distortion reaches a critical value. And what von Mises picked up was that if you hydrostatically strain a body, you will never ever yield it. But if there's any distortional strain energy which tries to distort the shape of the body, which is not hydrostatic, that will cause yield. And so what he did was he relied on defining the strain energy of distortion, UD, which we're not going to prove in the notes. Please have a look at Case, Children, and Ross. The entire proof is given there for you. This equation gives you the strain energy of distortion for a linear elastic isotropic solid. So remember, G is the shear modulus of the material. So you need to take my word for this, but have a look in Case, Children, and Ross for that. So the obvious question is, well, what critical value must UD reach before yield occurs? Well, let's use a very simple outcome to define exactly what is necessary. So again, we'll use exactly the same example as before. Imagine this being a long bar of material. We stretch it, it will yield when it reaches Y, stresses in the other direction are zero. This is the Mohr circle again. And what we can now say is that the critical value of UD is given by this, and we know all of these values, so we can plug them in. So if we plug them in for a particular situation of this material being stretched uniaxially, we will find that UD is y squared over 6g. And that must now be the critical value of UD, which will cause yield of this material. So we can plug this equation back into the original equation here to determine the generic equation for the von Mises-Yor criterion, which turns out to be that. And that is exactly what's stated in the structures data book. So now we have an equation which tells us exactly when yield will occur, depending on a completely generalized state of stress, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. So again, let's visualize this. We have those 4 points which we had before. That's nice and easy. And then we can rewrite the von Mises-Yor criterion, which is this, for sigma 3 equals 0, we can rewrite it as that thing there. Take my word for it, there's a very, very simple step to go from that equation to that equation, and that yield surface pluses an ellipse. So that's what it looks like, and it goes through those 4 points again, but instead of being the series of straight lines, which was the Tresckant criterion, it now is this ellipse at 45 degrees. What about when sigma 3 is not equal to 0? Well, the way to deal with that is to rewrite the Yor criterion, a bit of mathematical gymnastics. We can rewrite the Yor criterion to be this, and take my word for it, all that happens is we simply offset the axes by sigma 3 in both directions so that this will move up and down the page depending on whether sigma 3 is positive or negative. And that's how we vary it. But when sigma 3 is 0, it will have a center which is straight through the origin. So let's do a final example. A thin walled cylinder with closed ends has radius 50 millimeters, thickness 1 millimeter, and is made of material with a uniaxial yield stress of 100. It is the same problem again, but this time we're going to apply the von Mises yield criterion. We know what sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 3 are, and we can plug them, of course, into the von Mises yield criterion. So that's the von Mises yield criterion. We plug in those stresses that we know. We work everything out, we can plug in all the information we have, we've got everything we need, and we find that the internal pressure is 2.3 newtons per square millimeter, which is 15% bigger than the Tresckant prediction. So you might say to yourself, well, hang on, which is right? Well, you're going to find out. You're going to find out yourselves when you do one of the examples questions. So let's compare the two here. If sigma 3 is equal to 0, the two criteria can be visualized on the sigma 1 and sigma 2 plane as follows. As I said before, the Tresckant criterion, of course, is a series of straight lines. The von Mises is the ellipse. Now, remember, sigma 3 is 0. That's why if we can plot it with the center on the origin. And if we are pressurizing a cylinder, then we know that the hoop stress is twice the longitudinal stress. In other words, sigma 1 is twice sigma 2. So we actually are stressing it along that line. And you can see that the two criteria, it's about the worst situation possible to have them giving the biggest possible difference. So the two criteria are 15% apart for this particular sort of stressing, but for other forms of stressing, those distances apart between the two criteria in various parts around that, around those plots are less than 15%. But there's an example, as I said, in the example sheet 2.2. So you can now try examples, questions 10 to 13 in that example sheet.